This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Welcome to Conda Mason's Brown Rice Hour, a podcast that quilts together a fabric of connection between land, race, money, culture, and spirit. Discover a connection that engages with the most inspiring and cutting-edge thought leaders today, pointing toward our collective healing and liberation. If you are interested in supporting the Brown Rice Hour, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Conda.
Hello, everyone. I am happy to be back with you today. I want to welcome you to the Brown Rice Hour, where we have conversations at the intersection of land, race, money, culture, and spirit. My name is Conda Mason, and I am the host of the Brown Rice Hour. So today's podcast is going to take a different form than I usually do. Instead of interviewing one person, which usually you would see somebody that I'm interviewing right now, if you're watching on video, I will be interviewing three amazing individuals that I have had the pleasure of working with very closely on the Mindfulness Meditation Teacher Certificate Program, which the initials are MMTCP. So you may hear us talk about MMTCP. It is the Mindfulness Meditation Teacher Certificate Program, which is an online 2-year international training that has been, which is the heart child of Tara Brach and Jack Kornfield. And the four of us work for that program. And it is currently the program in its third cohort. And it's a 2-year program. So we are right now just finishing as the taping of this podcast. We are finishing up the first year of the third cohort. And so I work on this program with Jack Kornfield and Tara Brach and a host of other people as a mentor and as a mentor leader, as well as one of the co-creators of the DEIA program, the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Accessibility program. And so I'm one of the co-creators, and the other incredible beings that you're going to meet today or that we're going to talk with today are my posse that has helped to steward this program, which is a very innovative program for a mindfulness teacher training. And we are what I consider the dream team. And so I think that it's really important. I believe that this program, the DEIA program that we have all co-created, is an extremely important program. It is, I believe, the future of what needs to happen in mindfulness teachers training and in the mindfulness community, period. We will be talking from the point of view of training teachers, but everything we are saying translates over to just us as human beings, right? And so we are really working diligently on this program. It's been quite a joy and it's been a huge challenge. And so this group of teachers that you will meet today will share our highs and our lows and explain too why, no matter how difficult, this is what we must do in order to have a really diverse and to just work into the future that we all want. I hope that we all want. So pay attention. If you start to feel a little bit of discomfort, that's great. That is where we learn, in that discomfort zone, I think, and just stay open. And I'm going to bring them on right now. They are in my waiting room. So here they come. And here we are. So I am very pleased to introduce what I think of as the dream team. And in our DEIA world, in mindfulness world. And I'm going to begin by introducing, we have Kate Johnson, we have Crystal Johnson. Oh, I just realized that. And Don Haney. Duh, I never noticed that before. and so I'll begin by introducing Kate. And Kate is a Buddhist meditation teacher and writer who loves integrating embodiment, justice, and the practice of wise relationship in all of her work. She is the author of a book called Radical Friendship, 7 Ways to Love Yourself and Find Your People in an Unjust World, which is a wonderful book that I am currently reading. Thank you, Kate. She has been a dedicated practitioner in the Western Insight Theravada Buddhist tradition since 2008. She's taught meditation and creative movement practices as social change methodologies in public schools, community health centers, activist organizations, performance collectors for over a decade, and was fully empowered as an independent Dharma teacher through Spirit Rock Meditation Center's 4-year teacher training in 2020, where Kate was my Dharma sibling and we completed that program together. Kate is also an utterly unprofessional dancer who holds a BFA in dance from the Alvin Ailey School, Fordham University. She has a master's in performance studies from NYU. Most recently, most profoundly, most ordinarily, Kate is a mom. These days, you can find her writing, teaching, and facilitating online and in her home city of Philadelphia, where she can be found in the hours exploring with her kids, sipping tea with friends, and looking for all manner of good trouble. Kate can be found at katejohnson.com. Thank you, Kate, for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
Yay. I will now introduce Crystal. Crystal Johnson, PhD, so I will call her the doctor. Crystal is a retired clinical psychologist and a community teacher at East Bay Meditation Center in Oakland, California, which we lovingly called EBMC, which you may hear that acronym as we go, where she also serves on the Leadership Sangha, which is the board, and is a member of the Radical Inclusivity Committee at EBMC. Her teaching is focused on supporting white people in Buddhist sanghas, wider mindfulness community to wake up to whiteness and white supremacy culture and move toward action to work for racial justice. Crystal has designed and co-designed and taught and co-taught numerous classes, such as Unpacking Whiteness, White and Awakening in Sangha, and White and Awakening Together, The Journey to Connection. In Dharma communities, including the East Bay Meditation Center, Spirit Rock, the San Francisco Zen Center, and the Soto Zen Buddhist Association. Her most recent course is Many Communities, One Sangha, Exploring the Reality of Equity and Inclusion. She collaborated with Rhonda Musham Ikeda to invite white-dominated sanghas to identify the internal barriers they face and create community spaces that provide safety, dignity, and belonging to as diverse a group of people as possible. I love that. With Rhonda and Musham. Crystal also offers consultation to individuals and organizations seeking to disrupt the practices of white supremacy culture and support change toward racial equity. I repeat, she offers consultations. So you'll know how to get in touch with her. That is Kate. That is Crystal Johnson, the doctor.
The doctor is in.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Johnson.
So glad to be with you, Kanda.
Yes, yes. You can say, I love these people. All right. And last but not least is Don Haney. Now, Don is a teacher, coach, and consultant committed to helping communities and organizations learn how to navigate change while attending to dynamics of identity and power. They braid together wisdom from Buddhism, social justice, and psychology traditions, and alchemize this with their own experiences as a white, fat, queer, chronically ill, non-binary femme to support individual and community change through social movements from migrant justice to fat liberation. A Dharma student since 2003, she is a graduate of Spirit Rocks Community Dharma Leadership Program. We did that together. That was lovely. And a community
teacher.
We all
did that together.
We all did. That's right. We all did. Oh my God. Okay. We have to talk about that. And she's a community teacher at the East Bay Meditation Center and the Alphabet Sangha. They continue to teach on white anti-racism, feminism, disability justice, leadership, and liberation, drawing on their role as the former co-director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship to share wisdom at the intersection of Buddhism and social justice. Dawn is online at dawnhaney.net. Welcome, Dawn.
Good to be here with you all. Thanks, Kanda.
Oh my God. For having us. I am so excited to have this. I've been waiting for this moment to appear. That's right. We all did the CDL5 together. Wow, that's great. I've forgotten about that. So, wow. I am really happy to introduce. I have given, before you all came on, I've given a little bit of background as to what is happening here, that there is a program called the MMTCP program that Tara Brock and Jack Kornfield have created, and that we are part of making a change to that program. And that is by in cohort three, that where we are now, the program's in its third iteration, that we've created a program, the DEIA program, Diversity, Equity and Inclusion and Accessibility, to help make that program to serve the needs that are really needed. And so we put together this incredible team, the four of us, and it started out with Kitsy. Kitsy Shung was a part of it originally and did the videos with Crystal. And so this is also a hail to Christy, who is an incredible teacher as well in the Dharma and in white justice and white supremacy and anti-racism. So I want to begin with, I'm going to start with first, like, what is the differences when we have DEIA, diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility? Let's start from the beginning. People who are listening may not know, what is the difference between diversity, equity, and inclusion? Accessibility is a little bit easier to understand. We could talk about that, but there's a nuance between diversity, equity, and inclusion. Who would like to give us a little bit of background on how you define those differences?
Well, I can give it a whirl and then others can correct me. And I think simply, like, diversity is that you have a mix of people, like, of different backgrounds who are present.
Right. And
equity is that the sort of power and resources, you know, in the community are shared in a way that benefits everyone. And then I think inclusion has to do with safety, dignity, and belonging. So not only are people there, not only do they have access to the resources, but they feel like they belong, you know, that who they are is welcome. Mm-hmm. So that's how I would say it.
Yeah. And I'm going to, we're just going to have a conversation because I actually don't like those terms. You know, we use them because that's what we have. But I really take offense to the word inclusion, particularly. And I do because it is still centering whiteness. And it is saying, here's the standard, and we will include you into our party. Mm-hmm. And that's what it feels like for me. It does not take into, that's how whenever I hear the word inclusion, it just feels like I don't want to be included. I am also the standard, you know? And so I just want to say that diversity, I'm sick of that word too. And I mean, there's so much, right? I mean, tell me what you all think about those words? What is, how do they feel to you?
Yeah, I mean, I had a moment when you said, what do these mean? I was like, what do they mean anymore? You know, like, and I think that that, you know, that happens with language where, you know, we use terms and they start to get almost like stretched out of their meaning. I don't, you know, I agree with you. Like I inclusion without equity is like, not desirable to say the least, you know what I mean? That, if we're inviting, people of, people of color, people from like a marginalized group in society to be a part of a mainstream space, but we're not wanting them to fundamentally shift the culture and the practices of that space. And we're not wanting to shift the culture and practices of that space to make it more, more equitable and allow people to feel like be who we are, you know, wherever we are, then it's going to be awful and it's not going to work actually. I know that in my experience sharing with people, I mean, in the context of this program that we were going to be doing a DEIA training, I realized just how many different ideas people have of what that means. And I think that in part, that's because there's so many different ways to do that kind of training. I really love what we did. And I also know that, for many people, when they got into our training, they were able to really relax. But up until the point where the first module began, there was so much resistance, I think in part because, yeah, like DEIA, people think it's going to be boring. I'm going to be shamed. I'm going to find out that I'm not okay. Or I'm going to have to like learn a bunch of stuff that I already know. I think can mean a lot of different things. Not all of them are, I was going to say not all of them are valuable. And I don't want to like, I mean, of course I think our training was awesome. I didn't want to put down other people's trainings. I think what I mean by that is like, not all of them invite, a deep reflection, on our own identity and social location and lived experience. Some of them are just like spewing a bunch of like data or like facts on top of what has often been tremendous harm. And so, you know, part of what I'm interested in is like, not only how do we like learn, you know, what not to say in order to defend people, but how do we heal? You know, how do we heal ourselves? How do we heal our relationships?
Yeah, excellent. I love what you're saying. I'm wondering too, Dawn, you've been working in this space for so long, and the work you've done at Buddhist Peace Fellowship is extraordinary. Just extraordinary. The trainings, the pedagogy, it is to me. I think that work that you did there, and whoever you, and all the many things that you've done in life, have crafted you into this. So much wisdom in this training, and how to hold space extraordinarily, to tell you the truth. I'm wondering about those words, diversity, equity, inclusion, and I'm not missing disability because we'll come back to that as well. But I'm just wondering, do they work for you, or do you have any thoughts about it?
Yeah, I definitely did not want to be the person to answer the question. My first response, I was like, someone else answer that one, because I don't use them.
Good. What do you use?
Just to be honest.
Yeah. What do you use?
Well, before I even try to answer that, because I'm like, I don't know what words I use.
Okay.
I don't have a like, because at first I was going to try to like be cute and be like, oh, some people are using this term Jedi, where they include justice. And then, but I feel like it just like we keep trying to replace. We just keep adding words to the acronym to think that we can find the replacement that solves the underlying problem of centering whiteness. But the replacing of the words doesn't solve the underlying problem. You have to actually like changing the language doesn't solve the underlying problem. You have to actually change the, like, how you're approaching it. And so I think that's where in doing the work that we're doing, I haven't stressed that much about us using the DEIA language is also true, because it felt like, given the context that we were in.
Yeah.
Of a program that had gone through a couple of cohorts and not necessarily done a lot of work thinking about race and thinking about power, it was the language that made sense for this context to be introducing this conversation at all. So it also felt true to me to, like, not stress that much about it and not be like, we need the right language.
Yeah.
No, we need to, like, introduce.
Yeah.
We need to, like, help people, like, get into this conversation. That's the phase of work that we're in here at MMTCP. So I feel like in a place like Buddhist Peace Fellowship, we were probably using words like justice and liberation and
reparations.
I know, Kate, like, you were there also, so you might have some thoughts.
Right, you're on the board, right, Kate?
No, I was on the board. I did. I for a while I worked with Dawn, actually doing online programming for BPF, and then facilitating some of the Black Bill B gatherings.
All right.
Yeah, so we were just kind of in a different language set.
Yeah, this language just doesn't work. I mean, I agree. I accepted it because there were bigger fish to fry. Like, let's just get it out the door. We did add accessibility. So I do want to say that, because accessibility wasn't a part of it originally. And I think, Kate, was that you? I'm not sure. But there was the addition of accessibility, which is important, right? Which is about access, those who are who have less access, whether it's physical or emotional access, that and for us to center the training around that kind of awareness as well, accessibility. And every time I say DEIA, I'm going against a grain inside me. I hear it and I think, you know, let's just say it. It's okay. And I really, and you're right. It's like, there's no words to, it's bigger than a word. It's bigger than, but then you have to speak, right? We have to talk to each other and communicate language. And I haven't been able to figure it out, honestly.
You know, a few years ago, I was working on my book, and I went to a talk in New York with Zenju Earthlin Manuel. You know, I just read her book.
Which one?
The one with the beautiful sculpture on the front.
Way of Tenderness?
The Way of Tenderness. Thank you. And, you know, was just, like, deeply moved by it. And so I asked her, because I was really having a lot of anxiety writing about race and racial justice, and just, like, had this both the, like, white, well-meaning liberals who were going to get deeply offended mafia in my head. And then the other, like, inner critic was, like, the social justice mafia that was going to say I was not woke enough, because when I had written the book was, like, 6 months before it was published, and there was a word I used that was, like, cool then, that was, like, no longer okay. So it's just, like, battling a lot of these, you know, internal.
You chose the word.
I had no idea, right? But it's like the language is always changing. And so, like, you know, we could be one week, like, I mean, not by the week, but I think this really happened with the word ally, right? Where it used to be ally is a good thing to be. And now it's like, no, we're done with ally. Ally is dead.
Ally has never been
for good reason. But anyway, this was like a lot of concern, probably too much concern about what others were going to think, and worry that they would not be able to see through the language to the heart of what I was trying to say. And I asked her a question about that. I was like, how did you do it? Like, in internal level, how did you get up the courage to talk about waking up through race, class, and gender in a book, you know, that couldn't be changed, that for all the world to see? And then also, how did you write in a way where people could really hear you. And she said, oh, I just made up, you know, language for what I want to talk about. She said, like, with the, she's like, I didn't use affinity groups. I used I used cultural sanctuaries. I decided we'd call them cultural sanctuaries because I knew that when people heard affinity group, they think they know what I'm talking about, and they don't. And she said, then it was so interesting to see other people start to pick that up and call them cultural sanctuaries. And it just made me think about the like function of, you know, poetic language in this domain.
Just make it up.
Mm-hmm. What if we did that?
I love that idea of just making it up. If Zinja could do it, we could do it. Wow.
Or we could ask her to make it up for us. She probably have really great language.
No, I this is kind of a tangent. I'm not gonna go there.
Okay.
That's another podcast. But I have to say that language and how important language is, right? And particularly as Black folks haven't been called out of our language, out of our name, you know, hey, girl, boy, never given, you know, the decency of a name, you know. And I am in a, I'm in this very interesting space with another group of people that I'm working with that right now, as you know, and I don't think I did. I didn't put my pronouns on here, and I should have. I will do that as I speak. We have this tradition now. Let me put my pronoun. I'm putting our pronouns, right? And this is some older, as in their 50s above, 60s above, Black women who are really pushing back on that, on having to being asked, because they grew up in an era, and they're actually in their 60s and older, grew up in an era where them and their mothers are from the South were called out of their name, like she, hey, her, hey. And they're like, my name is blah, blah, blah. I only go by that. And it's a very interesting little culture clash that I'm in right now with the youngers and the elders that are having this conversation. So that, like I said, that's another podcast, but I'd love to get your all's feedback at the end of this on what that is. I'll tell you more about it. But the point is that language is important. Language is important. And we have been using, so we'll continue with the sake of clarity and ease with diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. And we all know that we don't like it, those words, but we will use them from here out. So I'm glad that, so I guess I want to start with about what we did, really. I just gave a brief introduction of the fact that there was this training, and I'll just say it again, that there was a teacher training that Jack and Tara put together that has been really profound and wonderful training. And this was my second year working in Kate too, the second cohort rather. And all kinds of issues. There's a lot of people in the training, a lot of students and mentors, and a lot of things came up racially that were, you know, microaggressions. There was a lot of harm when people get together. It's just racial harm. This is the story. And it kept happening. And it was clear that there needed to be a component that was a thoughtful component being created so that the next cohort would have this entire whole parallel track along with the curriculum, the mindfulness curriculum. There's a parallel track of 6 months of diversity DEIA training. And we made it up. We co-created that track. Kate and I did the track for BIPOC, which is Black and Indigenous and People of Color, the acronym BIPOC. And Crystal and Kitsy, who's not with us, did the white track. And Dawn came in after Kitsy left and has done a hell of a job supporting the team and being a part of the whole thing. So that is what we did. And I have to say that it was quite a lift. And I'm curious, I can let me just explain a little bit to the people what the overview is that, so again, these were for teachers. So as I said earlier, everything that we're saying, it was specifically for new teachers, but it translates to your life no matter what you're doing and who you are. But in this overview, I'll give you a couple of the sessions that were, there were six sessions. I'm gonna name all six sessions. So session one was there. So there was the BIPOC video and there was the white video. And everybody could see each other's videos. But the BIPOC saw the BIPOC and the white saw the white, and you could cross over and see each other. So in the BIPOC, so there was always, every session had two videos. The BIPOC video in session one was, how did we become people of color? It explored that. And it was for, on the white video, it was the invention of whiteness. That was the name of it. It was the invention of whiteness. Session two, we both did the twin dynamics of race-based oppression and white supremacy. Session three, the BIPOC one, was BIPOC solidarity, working with power dynamics. And the white one was called the challenge of being a good white person. Session four on the BIPOC site was resourcing ourselves, how to deal with racial microaggressions, bias, and racism as a BIPOC teacher. And on the white side is what to do when you are called out. Session five was teaching mindfulness while BIPOC, a panel discussion. And that was a panel discussion where we invited three teachers, Anushka Fernandopol, Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams, and Gomez. I'm sorry, what's your first name?
Maricela
Gomez. Thank you. And then on the whites, session five was calling other white people in. First one was what you do when you're called out. And this was calling other white people in. And our last session for the BIPOC was centering color and culture in the mindfulness classroom. And on the white section, it was unpacking white supremacy culture and holding space for a diverse community. So that's what we did. And we did videos and people watched the videos and they had homerooms and they talked about it. I'm curious, when I look back over all of that, Crystal, how was that for you in making the videos that you and figuring out the themes of what, if you had six chances to teach, how did you choose those six? And just what was your process in that, given as much the breadth of knowledge that you have?
So the course actually started out as a course at East Bay Meditation Center called White and Awakening in Sangha. And Don was actually part of the early teaching team of the class. And we offered it, I think, six times and got a good sense of kind of what the learning needs of white people are and kind of how to teach it in an accessible way, but also how to teach it in a way that motivated people to like take action. Right. Because, you know, we're not just trying to inform people.
Right.
Okay. There is systemic racism. We're trying to like convey that, you know, you've been raised up in this process. You have been created as a white person and you have been taught to behave in ways that are quite harmful to others without necessarily you realizing. Mm-hmm. And so waking up to that is painful. So you have to be prepared to realize, oh, it's not like they told me it was. And to realize, oh, I am, you know, not aware of these ways that I'm harming and I need to be aware. And so then once you realize that, it's okay. So how do I move into action? Like, what do I do differently? You know, because it's almost a joke now. Oh, white people, you know, black people get killed and white people form another book group. You know, and like you need the book groups, okay? Because like, you know, we need time in white groups to talk about whiteness, our relationship to whiteness, you know, the guilt and shame that comes out that we need to kind of move through, all those things. But ultimately, if our hearts have really changed, our behavior will change. And so what are the behaviors? What are the actions? What are the ways that we can move differently in the world, because I feel like that's what's actually going to change things. You know, it's not just a problem. Racism is not a problem of information, right?
Speak. Not a problem of information.
Yeah. It's like, you know, white people, like, you know, we learn about whiteness and white supremacy. Okay. So we know racism is there, but what is so easy for us to miss is that I'm actually keeping it going by enacting whiteness, by going along with the principles and practices of white supremacy culture. Nice little white girl me, I am actually keeping systemic racism going. And that's the thing that, you know, as white people, I think we really need to come to terms with. Like, it's not out there, it's inside of us, you know, because we've internalized what we've learned. And that's what we need to investigate and move beyond. Like, that I think is like the source of freedom for white people in doing this work. Like, there's some idea that, oh, well, you know, we have to give up all this stuff. It's like, one of the things I have to give up is like this isolation and separation, you know, from parts of myself and from communities of color. You know, there's this incredible separation when I like enact whiteness. And I have to not myself, I have to not know a lot of things. You know, I have to ignore the harm that comes from what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And that separates me. That creates like a big, you know, kind of painful space that I just don't look at.
Mm. I'm interested in when I think that there are people who, when they hear the words white supremacy, they're like, you know, they're getting all tight right now. So
yeah.
Loosen up, everybody. And I'm
relax.
We're going to say it a lot. White supremacy.
Get used to it.
But if you can, Crystal, explain, I think people think of white supremacy as, you know, like, you know, the Ku Klux Klan and the hats all those crazy groups that exist today. Can you explain that is not that and what it really is?
Yeah, so whiteness, sort of the creation of whiteness, it arose out of the period of European colonization, kind of starting in the 15th century when the Pope said, yes, everybody, if you're a Christian monarch, you can go out and take whatever land you want and kill whatever people you want, as long as it's in the name of God, and that's good. You know, and I'm sort of saying it that way, and some folks with Christian faith find that way of saying it offensive. And so, you know, I don't mean to offend, but it's a Christian European practice. It's a Christian European set of beliefs and principles and values that are still present in American culture and many other cultures in the world. And this is a culture where, whiteness is the superior color, where there's supposedly profound differences between white-skinned people and other-skinned people. You know, the individual is the super important kind of unit of analysis. Competition is important. You know, you get what you deserve. So if I work hard, I'll get ahead. So if there are other people who aren't getting ahead, it's because they're not working hard. You know, there are just a lot of ways of being, which I was raised to see as, you know, the way it is, which in fact are cultural practices. Mm-hmm. And so there's nothing wrong per se with white culture, with, you know, this emphasis on the individual, on duty, on kind of unemotionality, on, you know, silence, you know, kind of not really getting very personal. It's when that is held as the only way to be, the best way to be, and that resources in a culture are assigned to people with those characteristics, with that skin color and that kind of behavior. And, you know, violence is used to enforce those practices and that hierarchy of privilege. So when we think of white supremacy culture, at the extreme, you know, it's white nationalism, right? At the extreme, it's, you know, we're going to like violently create a whites only space and, you know, get rid of everybody else. But white supremacy culture in day-to-day life is in things like how media portrays white people and how less often they portray, you know, successful positive images of people of color. You know, it's in the ways that housing is still segregated in our cities, and the housing that white people live in on average is better than the housing that people of color live in. And then if you just start, you know, kind of with education system, there's discrimination in education, which leads to discrimination in employment, which leads to dramatic differences in wealth, which leads to dramatic differences in health. And, you know, it's this whole system of white supremacy culture where the people with skin like mine are actively favored through often violent processes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like as a nice white person, like I don't really want to be identified with these violent processes. And it's true that like I benefit from the operation of white supremacy culture in a material way. And so for me to really come to terms with that, it's not like I created it, you know, but if I live by it, then I'm kind of implicit. Mm-hmm. I'm complicit. Mm-hmm. And I'm complicit with the American genocide. I'm complicit with the practice of slavery that generated enormous wealth for white people in America that persists to this day, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's Ta-Nehisi Coates who has that great analogy. You know, he says, like the people who don't like reparations, you know, it's kind of like I maxed out all my credit cards, but then I cut them up. And I'm surprised that people feel like I still owe them money. You know, it's like all that wealth was created through exploitation. And it's like, you can't just like leave that be. You can't just say, oh, well, let's just move forward. Anyway, sorry, that was a very long answer to your question.
No, but it's all good.
It's such an important question because the terminology is disturbing until you really think about it.
And I think that that's really important because honestly, I hear it all the time that, you know, particularly like the people who are going to be watching this podcast who are white are probably more what I call the spiritual progressives types, right? And honestly may feel that they got this together, you know, I've got Black friends and what have you. And I know this stuff. And when you say white supremacy culture, still it's like, you know, the stomach hurts and it's still this image of the extreme. And it's really important for people to understand that every single American participates in that culture, myself included. I'm wondering also, Dawn, if you have anything to add to what Crystal was saying, and then I'm gonna ask you, I have a question for you, Kate.
Well, I think what I wanted to say here is like, to me, this is why we are doing this work in mindfulness communities.
Okay.
We're interested in mindfulness communities facing the racism that's in mindfulness communities. Like that's part of it. Mm-hmm. But part of it also is because mindfulness as a practice for me helps take a look at like my own experiences in white supremacy culture. It's not just something out there mm-hmm. that other people are doing. It's actually like how am I participating in it day by day? Mm-hmm. And that to me is part of the incredible work that is possible when you actually put mindfulness practice and apply that to facing racism and white supremacy culture. I think it's actually what can help. It helps decenter whiteness in a different way than just like studying it as an academic mm-hmm. exercise.
Got you.
So that to me is like why it's really incredible to be trying to do this work, not just helping mindfulness students, but helping people who are training to be mindful. Mindful teachers, mindfulness teachers, mm-hmm. you know, close to 2,500 students across the world to be thinking about mindfulness and racism together. Like, how is this actually something that helps us change our mindsets and behaviors together?
Mm. Yeah, that's right. I think that the marriage of mindfulness and this anti-racism work is the perfect marriage. It's critical to me for mindfulness to continue even moving any further. It's the racism, because people don't want to think this, it's like, well, you know, aren't we all cool because we do mindfulness? You know, you mean racism exists in the Dharma? And it's like, uh-huh. You know what, Kate? I want to talk to you about something, but that just reminded me of that situation that you had that day when you were leaving from a retreat and somebody mistook who you were. Can you tell us of that example of like just one of the most blatant things that happened is racism in the Dharma, if
was
you don't
when
mind.
We
you
were in teacher about? Training.
It was, yeah, when we were, you were leaving, you're leaving
yeah,
from down from,
yeah. Oh,
from
goodness. So I was walking up the hill to go to my dorm to remove my stuff at the end of our teacher training retreat. So kind of mentioned we did this 4-year training to be authorized as retreat teachers in the insight meditation tradition. And as I was walking up, there was appeared to be white man, yogi, meditator coming down the hill, who had just finished, was packed up with his things, looked like he had just finished a meditation retreat. And he kind of walked up to me and his eyes were bright in the way that, you know, people can be after their first meditation retreat or, you know, there. And he was like, "I just wanted to say thank you." And I was like, "Thank me?" And he's like, "Yes." He's like, "For, you know, keeping the meditation hall clean and for cleaning the dormitories, you know, after the retreat." And I was like, I just stopped and he said, "Isn't that what you're doing? You're here to kind of clean in between the retreats." And I said, "No, I'm a teacher." And he said, "Oh, what do you teach?" And I said, "Meditation." Like, meditation. And he just like kind of like looked bewildered and walked away. But I was,
it was painful. It's funny now, but it was painful.
I cried. It was, there's so much that I realize to signal when I'm in meditation spaces that I belong there, from, you know, carefully choosing my like neutral colored natural fabric clothing to, just all the really being diligent about, obviously being in practice. There's a performative element of mindfulness. There can be, you know, and there's a lot of pressure as someone who, doesn't appear to look close to what the mainstream idea of a mindfulness practitioner is, let alone a teacher, to try to perform, you know, that kind of Buddhist mindful vibe. And I am reminded over and over again in these meditation spaces where, you know, sometimes I'm a practitioner, sometimes I'm actually there to teach, that no matter what I do, you know, no matter how I signal, there will always be people who will only see me as there to serve their needs and to arrange the space for them and to make them feel good. And they just can't imagine why I would be there other than to be of service to them. And so that's the reality for like not only practitioners but teachers, I think. And it was something definitely in my mind as we were designing our track for the BIPOC teachers in training. You know, like how do we prepare ourselves to enter into spaces where we understand we may be harmed? How do we recover from that harm? How do we show up as loving presence for students who are coming from all different backgrounds and are, you know, not just some of them just barely awakening, you know, some of them really looking to work through with us some of what they're waking up to in their own hearts and minds, which is like not a really appropriate function of our role as teachers, you know? So there's a whole bunch of stuff. That was informed, I think, by our own experiences in the Dharma and Dharma communities, as well as what we've been hearing from fellow teachers and from students about their experiences in these communities that wanted to offer some perspectives and practices that would be helpful.
Yeah. Wow. You know, Kate, I think about, you know, how in general as being just a Black woman in America and many things that I do intentionally that I've been trained to do. Like when I go into a store, like now when you bring your own bags, you know, I make sure that people see this is my bag. I'm putting it in here. I'm not taking something out. I mean, I really do. I have this thing that I do. Mm-hmm. And so that you don't think that I'm stealing. And it's just this automatic thing when I walk into a store. One of the things for me in the meditation hall as a student, because, you know, we all play the role of teacher and then student and, you know, back and forth. And as a student role, I prefer to sit in the back. I like in the hall. I like being in the back, particularly I like going during winter where I could just like close myself down, hibernate in the back, get myself, and I just like go in, right? That's my thing. And it's always a room full of white folks. And because of that, I won't allow myself to sit in the back because I can't show up being in the back. I move forward where I don't really want to be. Mm-hmm. But I can't take the stigma of them thinking, oh yeah, she's supposed to be in the back. You know what I mean? Just stuff like that, that are the things that we overthink or that we have to look at that white folks don't have a clue that we do. And that's one of the ones for me that, and so what I often do if I'm on a long retreat, I start in the front, you know, like, and then I work my way back to where I want to be. Like, you know, now I'm choosing to be back here, folks. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's kind of honestly what I'll do, you know, and I think about all the many things that show up in as race and racism in the Dharma world. I don't know if you feel like doing a little bit of a teaching, Kate, but you did this wonderful piece in our videos on the four levels of race-based oppression. And if you remember what you did with that, or is that if I'm putting you on the spot, it's okay. I can come back around. But the four levels of race-based oppression are really important for people to understand. And it's playing off of what Crystal said earlier and talking about the systemic nature and it not being the, you know, the white hats and sheets. But there are these four levels that people should be aware of. Are you up for a little bit of teaching?
Yeah, well, I am up and I'm also, maybe you all can help me out because I'm new mother tired and I don't have all my files like right at the front. There are ways in which white supremacy and race-based oppression are out there. And there are also ways in which that they're like closer to in here. And our task as mindfulness teachers is really to be, and practitioners is really to be aware of them wherever they manifest. And also when we have a personal experience, to be able to ask ourselves this question, you know, does this experience have a systemic root?
Mm.
Yeah. Or is it just my anxiety or that I think this person's mad at me or, you know what I mean? Like, can I actually trace this experience that I'm having personally or interpersonally back to a societal structure that's acting through, that's enacting itself through my personal experience this moment. So, I don't have examples like at the tip of my tongue, but I can say, you know, one of the levels of, oppression is kind of cultural. And so it's the way in which kind of what Crystal was talking about, like white supremacy culture gets enacted in certain like cultural tendencies that are sanctioned as the norm or elevated as the ideal. And not only do they privilege light skin, white skin folks, but they also become expressed in certain tendencies. People reference the document. It's by Tema Okun and Kenneth Jones, Elements of White Supremacy Culture. So things like perfectionism, sense of urgency, worship of the written word. You know, and these things are not, they're present in culture at large, but they're also present within the culture of Western Buddhist and mindfulness spaces. And I think this is part of our work too, as teachers and practitioners, that not only do these cultural spaces have you know, exist within white supremacy culture, but they arguably unintentionally propagate white supremacy culture worldwide. But also, I mean, if we're not careful, right? If we're not careful, mm-hmm. if we're teaching and writing and giving talks kind of by default, it will default towards white supremacy culture because that's what we were, we were acculturated to. Not only that, but the tools of the practice have been themselves colonized in a way. And so part of our contemplation too can be like, how do we use our wisdom eyes and ears and hearts, you know, like use our wisest sensing when mm-hmm. we relate with the tools of the Dharma as we're taught them to kind of sift out, you know, what's the heart of the Buddha's teachings and what's white supremacy and what's capitalism and what's patriarchy.
So
that's kind of like the cultural level. And then we have a level of institutional oppression, which has to do with the kind of laws and policies that are enacted within many of the domains that Crystal talked about earlier, you know, healthcare and the law and education systems, housing, you know, the legal and the policy that have the laws and the policies that have systematically advantaged particular groups and disadvantaged other groups. And then we have the level of interpersonal
yeah.
oppression, where it shows up in, for example, this experience with this person that I had at the retreat, right? Where someone says something to me that's really harmful. Oftentimes folks that experience, I think most often people are aware of experiences of oppression at this interpersonal level, but they might not identify it as oppression. They identify it as some kind of interpersonal issue. So it's that Kate is an angry person and she doesn't like me, as opposed to Kate experienced a microaggression from me and is being, and now is being told that whatever she's feeling is her fault, you know, like, for example, when folks are not attuned to the ways that, oppression operates, white supremacy operates, it often feels like it's an interpersonal issue. And mm-hmm. like, why can't we just be kind of cool, as opposed to like, considering, you know, for the person in power, how is it that I might be, you know, enacting power, or as Crystal says, enacting my whiteness in a way that's making it impossible for me to for this person to connect with me in a safe way for them.
Yeah.
And then the internalized piece, which I think we spent a good deal of time talking about in mm-hmm. our track that we designed for BIPOC teachers in training. You know, what are the ways in which we become complicit in oppressing ourselves, and sometimes in maintaining white supremacy culture in ways that harm other folks of color? One of the big challenges, I think, in creating this track, you know, was that not that there's not diversity within the group of people that are, you know, experience white privilege in this world. And a lot of the, like, you know, emails and pushback that we got from white students was kind of like rallying for this, like, you're not recognizing our diversity. We're a diverse group of people. It's like, yes, we know that, you know, we know that in other, you know, ways that there, you may have nothing in common, but besides your white skin, you know, and that there's a common experience there that we're trying to unpack and point to in this particular training. And very much so for BIPOC folks, you know, that we basically, anyone who is not white was invited to take the BIPOC track, which included, you know, Black folks, Indigenous people from all around the world, Asian people, Asian American people, Pacific Islanders, folks from throughout like the Latin American communities and geographies, some people from the Middle East, you know, of course, the continent of Africa. It was, and here in the US too. So it was just a huge range of folks. And there's different, you know, depending on our geography, depending on our proximity to whiteness, we may have internalized, white supremacy differently. We certainly did, you know? And so I think part of the, so that was part of the challenge, is just like the real diversity in the ways people experience oppression based on not only geography, but also some of the other characteristics that influence how they experience white supremacy. So, you know, for me, for example, like I experience white supremacy differently as a light-skinned person, a person who has a white parent, a thin person, an able-bodied person, in this currently healthy person. So those were some of the things that we were unpacking in the training, is like, so all of us identify as BIPOC, and also what are the ways in which we also enact power structures and enact hierarchy based on our proximity to whiteness and other privileges in ways that harm each other. And this is a conversation that we can't have so easily when we're in mixed company. And so that was like one important learning task for us as BIPOC folks. I also know, and we talked about this a lot, Khanda, you know, and in designing the training, that many people I've experienced teaching in-person retreats will attend a BIPOC sitting group for the first time.
Yeah.
When they're in a Buddhist space. These are people who have privileges, other kinds of privileges, are like highly educated, have class privilege, are aware of those things, and maybe feel like they don't, mixed race people, third culture folks, people, you know, there's a whole bunch of reasons why people haven't felt like they fit squarely in and belong in a BIPOC space, and maybe tiptoe their way in for the first time when they're in a Buddhist or mindfulness space. And so we were also, you know, keeping in mind that while there are many people who may be, you know, identifying and have like done deep work around healing from internalized white supremacy and other forms of oppression, that a lot of people were kind of coming in and identifying for the first time. And that sometimes there can be so much pain around that people would rather not, you know, they're like, oh, please don't bring this up here. This is my sanctuary. You know, I don't want, you know, there's a lot of internalized fear too around making white folks mad. So it's like, don't ruffle the boat. Like, these are my friends. If we bring this up, they're going to look at me differently. We're going to have tension and awkwardness, you know? And so really wanting to be tender around that, because that's real. And then also knowing for some of us, when someone who is in a seat of power names that white supremacy is operational in a space, we settle. We settle. We can actually relax, because there's not an elephant in the room that we have to dance around or pretend to hide. That we can say, yes, this is the personal truth. This is how it is right now. There's a tremendous amount of relief in that too for some of us. So I'll just, you know, take a breath there.
What you're pointing to is so true. And it's, and that's why trainings and, you know, as long as we're going around it. This is what we've been doing for 400 years, you know, going around the issue and not really going through and dealing. And as we do, on the other side is liberation. And that's what people don't get. They think that, like you said earlier, I think, Crystal, that people feel like they're going to have to lose something or give up something. Yeah, you're going to give up something. You're going to get rid of the chains. And it's really about, it's really about, facing, being accepting, and dealing with the truth of the racial consciousness, the race consciousness in this country specifically, I'm talking, and it's the world. That was the other thing. And so, you know, there's a couple of things I wanna get to quickly. And one is that there's this question always, and we had it a lot, around why do you have affinity groups? Aren't we all just one? I mean, when it comes to mindfulness and Dharma, I mean, why are white people here and BIPOC people over there? Isn't this a theology about a oneness, and aren't you just making it worse and all those? I mean, boy, did we have that as a mainstay for about, you know, for many months. I'm going to read something that that our friend Ruth King wrote, who really has a very beautiful practice around what we're calling affinity groups, which Zinju called, what was it? She called it sacred. What did she call it?
Cultural sanctuaries.
Cultural sanctuaries. Okay. So I'm just going to read this quick paragraph. What Ruth King, who's a mindfulness teacher, an incredible, brilliant woman who has a book called Mindful of Race that I hope everybody has. She says, in a racial affinity group, our work is intensely personal. We have the opportunity to share our experiences and histories, examine our impulses, reinterpret meaning, and see clearly our role in racial harming and healing. Racial separation into same race groups, in this sense, is not unwholesome. Rather, it brings us into clear intention and is a critical step in developing from the inside out racial intimacy, literacy, and skillfulness. Regardless of how you identify racially, no one is exempt from the need to intimately examine racial conditioning. This is no shift in consciousness around race, neither knowing or part nor healing without the grit that relating to each other makes possible. Therefore, I recommend racial affinity groups, which she calls RAG, as an ongoing forum for investigating and transforming our individual and collective racial conditioning. And so I just love what she says. She's very clear about how important it is. And we even had, it was an interesting take on it. Mainly it's usually white people saying, why are you separating us? I want to be with the people of color, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, aren't you being racist? And then there were people of color who were saying, when white people go by themselves, it's never been good for me. So I don't really like the fact that they are separating and doing their own thing. I'm being excluded and I want to know what's going on over there. So, you know, there's just so many doors into questioning it and all legitimate things to think about. And it was something that I think is really important, even though we know the whole construct of race is a construct. And we ran into that quite a bit. Yeah. All the people who fed into the cracks who we ended up calling third space.
That's what I wanted to bring up is like, yeah, it was like the I think the third big voice of like, this is wrong, don't make us choose, right, came from right, a group of people right, who were like, you know, some people who are mixed race, some people who were like, you know, had grown up in one culture and then moved and kind of became BIPOC or became white, you know, from where they moved when they became adults. Some people who are a part of the dominant culture where they live, but globally we can be considered a part of a marginalized or oppressed identity. And so, yeah, it was complex. We did end up calling that space third, that group of people third space. And we did create an affinity group for them outside of the training. We still asked them to choose one primary track, either BIPOC or white, but we did kind of in response to this group of people say, anyone can watch any track that you like, but you're responsible for the learning tasks that are within the track that you primarily identify with.
Right.
Knowing that identity is imperfect, but I feel like that's the space of like learning and inquiry that I feel like I'm walking out of this training with and really wanting to know more about. Because I look back at some of the work that Don and I did together with BPF. And I remember specifically this one retreat that we were doing where it was a Black Build B, you know, retreat for kind of spiritual activists and active spiritual people. And we decided to do, you know, doing a day around like racial justice. We went into different, we called caucuses, I think then. And based on the specific identities of the people who were there, there were less than 100 people there. We divided into groups. I think it was white folks, Asian American people, Black group. And then we had Latinx and multi-lineage group. That was that's kind of how for the people there, you know, everybody would identify in one of those spaces. And what I remember is sitting outside, I ended up going to the multi-lineage group in part because my sweetie was facilitating and we were kind of like new dating. I wanted to like check out his facilitation skills, which were excellent. We're still together. I remember the Asian American group ended up staying inside, and then white folks and Black folks I could see out on the lawn, and we were sitting on the picnic table. And I looked up at one point, and the white folks had this like these like chart paper and like post-its, and they were like furiously making notes and like making charts and putting things up. Black folks were like in a circle, singing and doing massages, and the mixed people were just crying. We were just sobbing and like holding each other. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's so much pain here around not belonging, around being betwixt and between. And it's something that I often like, you know, I was struggled to even re-identify as a mixed race person because I fought so hard to be Black. And like, by the time I realized I could be Black, I was like, fuck this. I was like, I want to be with Black folks. And then it was like, you know, being Black and mixed race and letting in the kind of pain and not only the pain, but what can be known from that identity space of being neither nor, genuinely, not just that I don't want to identify because it's not convenient for my identity, but like that I have what I learned from Dawn to call meaningful contradictions in my identity that make it difficult for me to identify in one way or the other. That I feel like is a whole other body of work that I know I'm just exploring for myself and I really want to explore with others. Dawn, are you like, because you felt a lot of those emails.
I feel like that was so much of my work here. And I feel like you all helped develop did such work developing the curriculum. And then I was deep in student response on this question of where do I fit? Certainly we had a set of students who were just like, I don't want to face race. Don't make me. But this question of like, where do I fit? Where do I belong? And doing this work with students across 75 countries just really shifted my understanding of how to support students. Like, even if we're like trying to develop a curriculum, we have to construct enough understanding of race. Even if we understand race is socially constructed, we had to construct enough understanding of race as like a white track and a BIPOC track, that some folks would feel included in that and some folks would be like, there's just no possibility for me to fit in that. I just don't belong in that. And that itself is like such a core wound for those folks, that it was just like, that was like so much of the holding that I was doing and support I was doing for folks, that just really like taught me a lot. Like as Kate was saying, to just really like meet people of like, hey, I like, you have a meaningful contradiction here of like where to turn. And I see you in that and I support you in that. And like I am going to ask you to choose.
Yeah.
And I hear that choice is hard. And I'm going to hold you in that as a, like, what that choice is like for this curriculum, not for your life, not for like who you are, like what you're going to do for the next few months here in this particular curriculum. Yeah. I see that you are bigger than that. You are more than that. So that was definitely a huge part of the, just even like expanding our thinking and framing on this. So
I love that term, the meaningful contradiction. That's really beautiful. And I just want to say that, you know, like Dawn just said, you were the person who, where all the emails came, all the student questions, gripes, joys, because it was joyful too. But more of not when people contact, you know, they always contact with problems. I think that overall there was more joy for sure. But, you know, you get the loud people speaking and you think, oh, that's everybody. And it's just not, that's not true. But your tactfulness in answering those emails is like, I would not have been able to do it. I got to say, I wanted to just go over, and this is, we're going to have to come start getting to a close, but the DIA training, we had FAQs. We have FAQs, right? They're frequently asked questions. And some of them, the first one is, do I actually have to do this? It's like, yeah.
Yes, you do.
Tired. And I'm just going to read some of them. Why do you ask white people to meet with? And this came from the FAQs were based on the questions we were getting. Why do you ask white people to meet with other white people to do the training? Why do BIPOC need to meet in their own groups? Am I required to do this again? I identify as BIPOC, and it is very concerning to me that white people are meeting separately. I am BIPOC. Why do I need to participate in the DEI training? Where do I fit? I am in a required BIPOC affinity home group and someone in my group presents as white. Can we ask them to leave? I don't want to participate in the required DEIA training. Can I still do the program? It seems US-centric to focus on this. I don't think we have this problem in the country I live in.
I think
those are some of the major questions that came through that we had to answer. And I'm really curious too, just to hear, Crystal, I want to hear your answer too, especially that last one, because I'm, you know, the international group that thinks that this is a US-centric issue. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, let me just say though that as Kate and Don were saying, I think one of our great areas of learning while we were doing this was just the kind of the wide range of experiences that people have. And one of the dimensions that I hadn't considered, but that now I realize is very important is, you know, that the like US imperialism is kind of reproduced when we do this US-centric program and then say, okay, and this applies to everybody, you know, and it's like, oh, wait a second. It applies, right? The dynamics of privilege and oppression are present really in every culture. But what it looks like will be different because the construction of race is a social construction. It arises out of a particular history. And so while global whiteness shares a lot, you know, because of the common origin of, you know, European colonization, et cetera. That's not so true for the ethnic and class and gender conflicts that exist in many parts of the world, you know, where what we would see as race, you know, manifests really more as ethnicity, where there's a history whereby people of one ethnicity are oppressed by those of another ethnicity. And there is always the story of, you know, why this group of people is better, what the norms are, what the values are, all these kinds of things. What we want to do next time to improve it, of course, is to make those connections more explicit. Because, you know, the story of race in America is a very particular story. It's an American story. The story of race in Latin America also relates to European colonization in some ways, but it's also like a different history. You know, so we have students in this program who in Brazil are white. And if they come to America, they are people of color. So which track should they take? And what a wild thing, you know, that race is constructed in that way. You know, so it's not a fixed or changing thing. Kind of it's the story of a culture and why some people end up, you know, higher in a hierarchy than other people do.
Yeah. And I think that when I think about this, I always think about that it's around the experience. It's not about, you know, what race, it's like what experience of an experience of oppression in a certain way is what we're saying, you know, that's the common denominator, the experience. And so it's tricky. I mean, so I really want to, we've been going a long time and I can go on and on. I wish we should do part two. Are you all willing to do part two? Because we've just
scratched
the surface. Yeah, you up for that?
Yeah.
I think we should. And I think we should, because honestly, this has been challenging, this program. It's been very challenging. Like you said, you know, lots of people, international, how many countries, 2,500 students, mentors, who also were mentoring and needing to be trained themselves. And we did, and just so many levels of not knowing, so many levels of we need to learn from, and so many levels of harm. And so, but also I have to say that I had a wonderful kind of going away, because Kate and I are actually leaving a certain part of the program right now. And there was one of the mentors mentioned, just they just told stories of students who started out really reticent, did not want to do this, completely did not want to take this DEIA training. Why am I doing this? I thought this was supposed to be a spiritual, and ended up transforming. And they told me the stories. And it was so wonderful to hear. And one in particular, who this person who is a guy, a white guy who really hated it, didn't want to do it, ended up getting softening through and understanding, oh, I didn't know this. And at the end, there's something called a practicum that the students do. And actually, as his practicum, he's doing DEIA and mindfulness. And so those are the kinds of things that have happened. And so I personally feel that this has been an incredible opportunity to really marry what needs to be married through everything. But for the mindfulness community to really embrace and understand how racism exists in all of it. And being proactive, accepting that truth, and being proactive in learning and bringing in doing the good hard work that we're talking about is the only way through this elephant in the room that you were talking about, Kate. And so I just want to say that I'm really proud of the work that we've done together here. It has not been easy. I have learned from all of you. Every time we get together, it's like, oh no, not another. And then I'd hear and I'd learn from each of you and how you respond and how much heart, you know, and wisdom that you all have. And I thank you as teaching me so much in this process. I think that I want to thank also Tara and Jack for making this happen, because they insisted that this has to happen. And for those people who said they don't want to do this program because of that, they said, well, I guess you won't be doing the program. And I am grateful that they are so committed and that they are hopefully leading, you know, this challenge. And it's challenging, you know, it's hurtful, it's hard, it's all these things, microaggressions that I've experienced that have, you know, and there's just so many things. And it's the work that we have to do. And I think if we're not experiencing issues, then we're not doing the work, because it's a mess. We have messed this up so much as human beings, right? That if there's no issues, you're bypassing. If there's issues, you're dealing. And so it's just like, we got to clean it up. We've got to do this work, everybody. And so I'm really grateful for this program that we have taken it on. We will be revising it. It'll get better and better. I know. And I just want to say that it is incumbent upon this sector, particularly as we talk about liberation. You know, we talk about mindfulness as this path to liberation. And honestly, it's been a path to a lot of other things other than liberation. And so if we can, as Dharma mindfulness practitioners, students, teachers, insist on whatever we're doing, that we're doing the deep work on this. And until that happens, we will make ourselves irrelevant, is what I see. That, you know, there's that hyper individualistic me liberation, and with, you know, my head in the sand, not looking at we, because it's the we liberation that really matters, as far as I can see. So I just want to say that. I want to thank you all for coming, for being a part of my podcast. I am so thrilled, and I love you all so much. And I know that whoever's watching this podcast is loving you like I am. And this was, honestly, our meetings once a week on Wednesdays was like the highlight of my week, when I know I was going to see my sisters. And we were going to, you know, be real. So I just thank you for who you are and the work you've done in the world to make and for serving the way that you do, because it's hard work, and you continue to step up to the plate and to serve. So much love and blessings to each of you. I don't know if you all have a closing word, a closing sentence, a closing moment. Please let me hear you say something.
just for me, this has been such a dream team. And I feel as if I have really grown in my capacity to engage with white people around these really difficult issues. And yeah, y'all rock.
And how can people find you, Crystal? You have a website or?
I don't actually. You know, they can find me through East Bay Meditation Center. There's an email, whiteandawakening@eastbaymeditationcenter.org.
Beautiful. Thank you for your work. What about you, Dawn?
Well, I love you all. This is such a dream team, and I definitely have learned so much in our process. And I just like have been noticing all the overlapping ways that we have worked together, like so many things that we have, you know, certainly our CDL5 work together, but other things that we've done as well. And so part of me is like, well, what's going to come next? I don't feel like this is any kind of ending.
No, not an ending.
This is like, okay, like here is a big development that we really put some effort into and learned a lot from, and will inform whatever comes next in the next configuration. So I'm excited about that.
Yes. And where can people find you, Dawn?
DawnHaney.net is probably a good place.
Wonderful. Thank you. Kate Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, just echoing the love, you know, like I also feel like I've learned so much. I also feel like you're fielding the challenging questions, sometimes the resistance from like students, from mentors, like really brought me to a little bit of an edge internally, you know? And so I both want to say just how grateful I am for the like mutual support and care that I found in this group, you know, when I didn't even realize I was getting a little crunchy and a little, you know, like you guys put lotion on my hurt feelings, and I really appreciate that. It's kept me moisturized spiritually. And also yeah, that I feel like I grew in compassion, you know, in this process, really for, you know, saw some of my own areas of unconsciousness, and saw also just places where I still had room to grow. And so I feel like I would love to work with you all again at any time. And I also am feeling a lot of gratitude for the students of the program, just their willingness to like show up anyway and show up with their doubts and show up with their concerns and show up with their, curiosity and show up, but just to be willing. I know that we made mistakes. And so I just appreciate their grace and their willingness to take what is useful and what is wise about what we offered, and to let us know where we had room to grow.
Yeah. Beautiful. All right. I have to let you all go for the moment off the podcast. Thank you for saying yes. Thank you for making this happen. Thank you for being in my life and continually being my companion, my teachers, my friends. I love you all. And we'll see you around the way. Blessings, everyone. Bye-bye.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.